360 Yourself is a dedicated podcast meeting brilliant minds and looking at the world around them. How do they 360 themselves and 360 the world? Jamie Neal, the host, that's me, asks many questions about their mindset and how they fundamentally operate their world and the world around them. Hello, how are you doing, Jim?
I'm very well, thank you, Jamie. How are you?
Good, good. I'm very, very well. I've had a really good morning. I was up early. Actually, my housemate was like, you haven't been up since, like, I don't know, since like 7 a.m. in a long, long time. And I was like, yeah, usually I'm up at like 12. But actually today I was like, oh, I'm up at 7, I'm doing live. It's actually really, really good. And you just came from, where have you come from this morning?
I was in a little village called, well, I was driving to the house yesterday and I drove halfway between there and stopped at a pub called the Fox at Crawley. It was really nice. Stayed there. A friend of mine is the GM there. She was like, come and enjoy a night. And it was nice. Really, good, really good. Lovely night. But I mean, I didn't sleep very well.
You didn't sleep very well?
No.
Do you usually sleep quite well?
Yeah. But yeah? It's strange bed syndrome.
Right.
Know?
Okay,
so I was enough. Like, I was a bit disorientated.
Yeah. My bed at the moment is like a king size bed with memory foam. So like any other bed now, I'm like, I can't really do that at the moment.
Yeah, mind you, Soho House's beds are always pretty cool.
The one in Boundary Hotel in New York is also pretty good.
Okay, really good. I saw that on your Instagram.
So, yeah, really, really nice, really nice hotel. I would definitely advise that name drop, Boundary Hotel.
They're sponsoring you now, are they?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. They're sponsoring this podcast. But I want to say thank you so much for giving me your time. As always, it's always great to meet friends and them giving me time for this podcast, because I think it's really important when I meet really cool creatives that have a way of thinking about their life and what they're doing. I find it really fascinating that I think other people should be learning about their tools and stuff and how you kind of... navigate through life. And you've had a very, very interesting kind of experience life, working in advertising and then working in film and screenwriting. And I know when we first met, I was mesmerized by your stories, so I think it's only best that we get it on podcast. But what I want to start with is kind of like, how did you start off? Like, where did you go, what's your story?
Right, so what basically happened was, when I was 16, 17, I was going through that thing that you do when you're a young adult and you're looking to find out what you're going to do in life, and I was doing A-levels I was doing economics, biology and physics, and I was shit at them because I basically discovered girls and alcohol, and probably the worst time of your life to discover those two things.
Yeah.
So I was halfway through those and I was just failing everything, and you know, my mocks were terrible, and I was just getting lots of pressure from the family. And now my dad was a police surgeon, right?
Ah, okay,
and he worked in forensic science, but he was basically he was like scene of crimes guy, and he always used to say most murders happen at meal times.
At meal times, in the evening or in the afternoon?
I don't know. Maybe the evening, but maybe I think it's hungry people, hangry people,
right? Okay.
Right. So. I was given the job. I'd just passed my driving test to go and get the family fish and chips from the next village one Thursday night.
Of course, yeah.
And I was driving like Lewis Hamilton to go and get the fish and chips because I was hangry and I wanted to get the fish and chips sorted out and bring them back to the family. And I rolled this car into a ditch.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the first car that stopped, I got out, you know, I hurt my shoulders and head a bit, but I was, you know, wasn't badly hurt. The first car that stopped was the local police sergeant, and he was like, oh, who knew my dad and knew the family, and said, oh, come on, I'll take you back, James. So he took me back to my parents' house. I walked in, the sergeant explained what had happened. My dad and my older brother then took me back down to the car to see if they could recover the car from the ditch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when we were down there, my elder brother, I don't know why, I think he thought he was like trying to show some sort of level of, I don't know, maturity or just gung-ho-ness, punched me.
Why?
At the side of the road, just chinned me. And I was like, what? He was just pissed off that I'd rolled the car. I don't know. I mean, I've never, this day, I've never actually questioned him about this. So I was about a mile from my house. I ran back to the house on my own because they were fiddling about with the car trying to get out of the ditch. Got 3 jumpers and £40 in cash, which was all my savings, and left home.
Literally?
Yeah.
Left home.
And I didn't see my dad or my folks for probably 9 months after that.
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I ended up in London, and I was there was a guy, Neil, his name. He was my manager for a while when I first started writing, actually. And he worked at the Latchmere Theatre, and I knew him because he was a friend of a school friend of mine, but I'd only met him once. And I went to the Latchmere Theatre, which in Wimbledon. I hitchhiked to London that night. Got to the Latchmere Theatre just as though he was locking up, closing up, and I went, "Hi, I'm Jim. Remember me, Nigel's friend?" And he's like, "Yeah." I said, "Have you got anywhere I can stay tonight?" And he was like, "I have absolutely no, you know what? Huh?"
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, and he took kind of pity, and he said, "Like, for one night you can stay on my couch, but then after that you're gonna have to, you know, fuck off."
Yeah, yeah.
And it turned out that Heather, Nigel's sister, had dated this girl. There's this guy. It's very convoluted, but it turned out that he said to her, "Your brother's best mate has just turned up on my doorstep. What do I do? You know." And she went, "Oh, you can come and stay with me." So the next night, I go and stay with her. Anyway, I don't want this to be a long biopic. What happened was I got a job as a road sweeper in Covent Garden.
Okay.
Right? And I made a lot of money road sweeping.
Wow, cool.
Because they were doing, you started at 5 in the morning and you went till 2 in the afternoon and you got paid normal rates. If you worked weekends, they doubled that.
Wow.
If you worked like a bank holiday, you got quadruple money. If you worked after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you got time and a half. Basically, I just worked every hour I could. And I was earning more than the management wage, the average management wage in those days in London.
Wow.
Just sweeping the roads at Covent Garden.
Yeah, yeah.
And my dad, eventually, I think Nigel's sister or Nigel said, he's in London, he's doing this thing in Covent Garden. And my dad came down, and I was outside the Theatre Royal Drury Lane sweeping, and he walked along the pavement towards me, and he was like, "I'm really proud of you that you've managed to survive." You know, this is like 9 months
The
road, that you've managed to survive these 9 months without having to, you know, on your own.
Yeah,
so this accident happened. I was sweeping outside of the Theatre World, not the Theatre World, the Café Royal, and this guy in a Bentley reversed his Bentley into my sweeping caddy truck thing and got out and started shouting at me because he couldn't see it he couldn't see the caddy thing with the brushes and what have you in, and I started shouting back because he was pissed and I'd been working a long day. And I'm like, first you're on double yellow lines, secondly you're drunk. Let's wait till the police to arrive and we'll see who, you know. And he was like, "No one's ever spoken to me like that before. Here's my card. I want to see you in my office on Monday morning." And he gave me my first job in advertising.
Oh, wow. So random.
I know. And he it was a very old agency, ABM. And he said, "You could be a bag carrier. We'll get you suited and booted. We'll meet you. But, you know, we've got some pretty dodgy clients on one end and we want, you know, somebody who's a bit of a lad to hang out with them and make sure they get what they want." That started my career in advertising. Scooch forward to, I'm 33, I've got a Porsche, I've got a beautiful house.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a place on the beach. You know, everything is doing awfully well. I'm a director of an agency, big agency group. And this success has just gone through the roof, a lot of cocaine. Like, I'm doing 40 grand a year.
Wow.
Yeah, no. And probably the same in Champagne. It was a dirty time in the 80s, I tell you. And I have a meeting with the managing director of the agency and a client. We deliver a load of stuff, a load of creative, and it's the best creative I think this agency has ever, ever done, and the client didn't like it. And as we're driving away from the meeting... As we were driving, and I'm 33, as we were driving away from the meeting, I look over to the managing director and said, I can't do this anymore. And he goes, don't be stupid. Just, you know, all clients are assholes eventually. You know, don't worry about it. It'll be fine. We'll turn him around. It's like, nah, I can't do it. And we
was
get...
Was it because the creative was so good and you just didn't...
No, because I couldn't deal with trying to sell something...
That you knew was good.
That I knew was good to some... But it was more than that. I didn't love what I was doing. In fact, I hated myself because of what I was doing. I used to call it lying for a living. And I was brought up pretty well and morally well. And in the 80s, especially, advertising was quite a dirty place to be. As I said, it was a lot of alcoholism. There was a lot of, you know, it wasn't as clean as it is today. I mean, I look at ad people today and I meet them from time to time, and friends of mine that stayed in the business. And it's so much cleaner than it was in the 80s.
Yeah, sure.
And the 90s. So, yeah, no, I just hated me, and I was fat, and I just didn't want to continue doing what I was doing. So I'd kind of made that choice before, but that was the thing that pushed me over the edge. And because it pushed me over the edge, it made me go, I hate everything in my life. So I pulled everything down. I smashed all the castles. I got difficult. Well, I left my wife. I broke everything. I smashed it all together. And of course, I ended up, luckily, because of the huge insurance that I was under, the key director insurance and everything, I ended up in a private mental home, being detoxed and being reset. And during that reset, this guy, Peter Morgan, great guy, he's dead now, but he was a psychiatrist, went, firstly, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put you to sleep for 3 days. Okay, so you're just going to sleep for 3 days. And when you wake up after that, he had certain old school practices, and he said that this was done in World War One, when people came back with shell shock, that they put them to sleep. They put them under anaesthetic for 3 days. And it allows you to kind of reset your internal clock. And you can't fight something if you're weak. So let's try and get some strength back into you. It worked. I mean, it really did. I mean, it was so good actually that I went back and did it again when I was fine.
Yeah, just sleep for 3 days.
Right. I went back and was like, Peter, can you just admit me, you know, please?
Just because I need some sleep.
Because no one can get at you when you're in a hospital place, and you're basically, you know, it was like a 5-star hotel, except you couldn't drink. Right? But the food was great, and, you know, it's all individual rooms and stuff. So it was lovely. Anyway, in that process, a lot of questions were asked of me as to why, you know, why would I want to break everything down? Why would I want to not be, you know, on the outside, it was completely successful. You know, what people... But
deem as success.
Yeah, 33 years old. I had, you know, everything at my fingertips. And, you know, so young and so successful, but so depressed.
Why, though? Why was that?
Because nothing was paying, nothing...
Because you didn't have to work. But, of course, you had to work hard, because, obviously, you're still in demand with the client. So the work and the effort is still there. So it's not like everything's coming to you.
I think I felt ashamed of what I was doing. I didn't feel it gave... I felt like I was, as I said, lying for a living. I spent a lot of time, you know, and people will relate to this, because a lot of people do jobs where they're, you know, they'll walk away and they'll go, why am I dealing with this asshole? You know, why, you know, that person, and they can't, because the guy's got the money, because the guy's got the power, they have to put up with it, and they have to, you know, the amount of clients that I took to Berlin, bought prostitutes for, or fucking, you know, I'd be driving... through Switzerland with a client, and he'd suddenly turn around and go, I want to buy a camera, and the agency's paying for it. You know, it was so corrupt in those days. It wasn't, you know, that's what I'm saying. It's clean now. It wasn't then. And, I mean, there was yachts given, you know, rented for clients for 2 weeks, you know, over the summer holidays, so they could go out there and screw prostitutes and stuff. So you felt, wow. Yeah, you didn't.
Crazy. I mean, it's different. But obviously, if you were doing it now, it'd be totally different and maybe a different outcome.
Well, also, it was, as was pointed out to me, it was even then it was illegal, right? Mm-hmm. Even then, you're actually your corruption and fraud is all, you know, it was illegal. You could go to prison for facilitating it. But there's so many stories out of that that I don't want to. It's not a book, but what it taught me, and it, you know, that saying about give a man a job he loves and mm-hmm. he'll never work again, mm-hmm. was that Peter found me that job, mm. and he said, well, you know, why don't you write something? Why don't you write something of length? Because I used to write TV commercials,
oh, right.
so I could do like a minute and a half. Mm-hmm. And he was like, no, why don't you write something which is 90 minutes long or 30 minutes long or what have you? And I wrote from the hospital. I started writing this thing called Last Breath, which was a radio play. I didn't know it was a radio play because I wasn't a writer, but it was a play, and it was about a guy lying on a hospital bed with his wife on one side, his daughter on the other, and they're talking about him whilst he's on a life support machine, and you can hear the audience can hear him responding to them, but they can't hear.
Yeah, for sure.
So this sort of piece about him apologizing for where he got, you know, everything that they're then talking across his almost dead body about. Mm-hmm. It's called Last Breath. And it got nominated BBC North Playwright of the Year.
Amazing.
So I got basically a nomination on the first thing I wrote, and I didn't know it was meant to be that difficult.
Yeah.
So I got out of the hospital. Time went by. There was a lot of period of gnashing of teeth and, you know, trying to work out money and stuff. And, you know, I still had a family to look after, so I still had to work out, you know.
But at this point, you were divorced, though, weren't you?
Divorcing.
Yeah.
And what actually happened was got the nomination, got a agent. And again, I mean, I think... I'm a great believer in asking the universe nowadays. I'm definitely a believer that sometimes you're on a path that you can't change, that it's preordained where you're gonna go.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'm really lucky.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really lucky, and I don't know why, but I don't think it's necessary luck. I think I just happened to turn the right corner. So I bumped into this guy from Time Tees Television who got a job outside of the TV business, and he'd been recruited by Zenith to make films. And he said to me on a Monday, I've got this great job. And we'd had a conversation before when I was in advertising about how I was producing commercials on £400,000 a commercial, mm-hmm. and he was having to do a whole series on £400,000.
Wow.
Right? And I'm like, well, you know, it's not about the money, it's about creativity.
Yeah.
And he was like, no, it's not, it's about the money. I want some money. So I bump into him and he said, I've got this great job. I'm head of development at Zenith and they're looking for films. Have you got a film? And I was like, yeah, I've got a great film for you.
Obviously, you didn't right? have I had nothing. In your pockets. You had to go home and write it, yeah?
And I wrote a thing called The Yomp, which became Runners. Again, this film has never been made, but I get so much work because of it.
How do you get work because of how you write?
Because it's a very good writing sample. And basically what happened was Zenith bought it.
Yeah.
Straight away. I wrote it in a week.
Wow.
On the Friday afternoon, I rang him and said, I'm sending it over now. Send it over at 4:35. He rang and said, we want it.
Cool.
Right? Now, no one had told me it was meant to be difficult. So I just wrote a film.
Yeah.
Zenith came in with most of the budget. Then started bringing the budget with First Independent Films, Zenitrobe, which is Lars von Trier's company. Mm-hmm. And they'd already cast David Bowie as the baddie. I mean, this was, for a first-time writer, this was going to be massive.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you know the business with film, when they start putting money in, mm-hmm. into place or they spend money,
mm-hmm.
that stays with the project. So if it goes into turnaround, if you can't make that film for whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
and what happened was our distributor went bust and we lost the bulk of the budget.
Yeah.
The money they've spent developing it stays on that project.
Right.
So if I'm going to go and pick it up from Zenith, who actually also went bust after Biker Grove got cancelled.
Ah.
So I was on Biker Grove.
Oh, right, okay.
As a part of the deal, because they were literally like, give Jim some work.
whilst we're setting up the deal,
getting all the money together to actually make the film. Every now and again, the guy called Peter Chapman, who was the director, will contact me and say, "I reckon we can make this for $2 million," or he'll come back, you know, because I love the project, and maybe it does need a bit of rewriting now because it was a European road movie. And it was about some kids from Newcastle. I was very sort of affected by Ken Loach, and I wanted to write something gritty. Mm. And it's about some kids in Newcastle who run away, and they get on a ferry and they go to Amsterdam, and they get met by this guy who meets them, who's basically trying to get them into child prostitution. He takes them to Berlin.
Wow.
And he's pulling them through Europe. They get to Berlin, and whilst they're getting there, they're realizing that this is not good for them, mm-hmm. and they're trying desperately to escape and run back, basically.
Right.
So it's called the Yomp, which is an army term for marching up and down a hill,
mm-hmm.
and they changed it to the Runners or Runners. Still out there, but it just hasn't been made. It's a bummer for me, but there you go. But it gets me loads of work. People read the script and go, "Oh yeah, this guy can write."
Right. Okay. So you send it as a sample thing.
Yeah, my agent does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was, and that, in fact, the film that I'm least proud of, but happy that actually did get made, was this one, Tom and Thomas, which is Aaron Johnson and Sean Bean are in, mm-hmm. and basically it was written by the director, Dutch lady, Esme Lammers, and my agent basically whacked the script by them and said, because they were looking for writers to go in and do the polish and, mm-hmm. and bring it, and because Dutch was her first language, and whilst they speak perfect English in Holland, they're not necessarily great at bringing that English to the screen. So I went and worked with her directly and brought the script into to what it is now, and the reason I'm proud of it is because it's 6.8 on IMDb or 6.7 is its rating, and it's a Christmas film,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and the best Christmas film in the world, which is Elf, everybody knows that,
mm-hmm.
is 6.9, so it's only 0.1 below.
There you go.
And that always makes me very happy, especially it's on every Christmas now as well, so that's I nice. Get to see it and go, almost as good as Elf. It's not. It's terrible. Almost. But anyway, interestingly, part of that journey to get to the writing bit, and it does sound, because I meet writers all the time and they go, "Sorry, so you wrote something and you got nominated straight away, and then you got a film deal in a week."
Yeah.
And I go, "Yeah, but no one, I've had a lot since, I mean, I've been writing for now over 15 years. Like nearly 20 years. So in that period of time, I've had a lot of time when I haven't had any work."
Yeah, of course.
So it's not like, you know, I just managed to put it up at the front, you know, but I do enjoy it, and that's the thing. And I think if you love what you do, then there's nothing, you know, no one can argue with you.
You're just
full of like, yeah, let's do this
for sure, you know? Sure. And we were talking about earlier before the podcast started, mm. the whole kind of new mindset that you have. How did that kind of develop from when coming out of kind of the institute and that sort of thing?
Well, I was saying to a friend of mine the other day, I think I've had three lives. The first life was that early stage of leaving home, finding my feet, building a career that I didn't want, and yet I was good at, and then it didn't pay me back, and I had to escape it. The second life was entering this world of writing, and the second life of that is a very competitive business. Mm-hmm. You spend a lot of time. It's not a necessarily lovely business. There's a lot of two-facedness. There's a lot of stress. Or you can let it get to you,
mm-hmm.
right? Or you can override it, right? Mm-hmm. And I do spend a lot of time just like, it's fine, mm-hmm. letting it go. But in the early stages of that career, when I'm working on shows where I worked on The Bill, and there was like 24 writers,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we all get together like once or twice a year to do like storylining for the year, and that you don't want to get 24 writers anywhere near each other. It's mm-hmm. like it's frenzy. Yeah, and it's not healthy.
Mm-hmm.
It's so competitive, and it's so, you know, and there are, I'm not one of those people. there are writers that really shouldn't be allowed in public, right? But they are immensely talented people, but they're missing something social, you know,
yeah,
that's how they've managed to, you know, live in this solitude and get on with it. I can't do it. I've always written in bars or public. I need to get up every now and again and talk to people. I can't be alone. I just said I've just got back from Tuscany and I spent a week or 10 days writing on my own in a country where I don't really speak the language. And at some point in that process, I did start to feel a bit, I'm going crazy. I need to speak English to somebody soon, you know? So I'm not that genre of writer. I'm a talker as well. But no, interestingly, and I don't know how long this needs to go on for. You know, I don't want to bore anybody, but
not at all.
But what this third life? So the beginning of the writing career, very competitive, very like on it. I was hungry. I had no money.
Mm-hmm.
That was very important because I one thing I definitely realized is before I got the ability to feed myself properly. I mean, it was horrible, you know, it was running out of cash left, right, and centre. Horrible periods of time not knowing how I'm going to, you know, get money to my ex-wife and the kids and stuff like that, is that was a really big motivation to work. And once I got into getting residuals and repeats and, you know, having money again, the work level, you know, I probably write two things a year now, you know, and I was writing two things a month at the beginning. But also, you know, that's what hunger does to people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you have to survive. So this third life is less about that, more about the quality of life, and also the quality of work. So I have three projects on the go, and these are the three things that, you know, will get made because they're the most the best things I've ever written, and I'm doing it at the pace that I know will get them over the line and have the quality that allow them to be the pieces that I am proud of. And this third bit is also quite interesting because you take stock on life based on, oh, hang on, my success isn't actually money or houses or cars or yachts. My success is I've got these people I call diamonds in my life. And I've got about 6 to 8 diamonds at the moment. They do fluctuate. And they're just people that I've collected in my life that are so important to me. And that I know that, and they're scattered all over the world. You know, there's one in LA, one in Berlin, one in, but I know 24/7 they're there for me. And I'm 24, you know, they pick up the phone, send me an email, send me a text, I'll be there, you know? And the joy I get from those people, and I completely think that's what makes me rich, having this collection of diamonds. And, like, you know, they're coming into my life all the time. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm going to stop at 8. It's just you know, until you sort of identify that this is where all your fun and all your love and all your happiness is coming from, right? And then you go, oh my God, how many diamonds have I let slip through my hand in the past? Because we all meet people and love them and what have you, and then they've, for whatever reason, you know, we split, we don't see each other, and then it disappears. And I think that's true. A lot of people say, what do you think is success? And I think success is a big table. And I visualize now a big table somewhere hot outside, surrounded by people who I love, and that to me is success. That is the essence of success.
Amen.
The big table. I need a wee wee.
You need a wee wee.
Yes.
Okay, 1 second. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back.
Thank you. Sorry.
And we are back, and Jimmy has just come back from the toilet.
Sorry.
It's all right. We these kind of podcasts, we have a lot of coffee and beers and all that sort of thing, so our bladders can. And to sit down for 45 minutes is quite a lot as well, without going to the toilet and that sort of thing.
Especially at my age.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're only like 40, aren't you, about?
No.
So also just kind of following on from mindfulness and your kind of diamonds and that sort of thing. I mean, it's interesting because as you're coming up in the world and you're young and you're wanting to be successful, and you think success is career and how much money you make and how many clients that you work with and that sort of thing, it's a lot of people need to just think about actually the moments in your life where you remember, are the dinners that you have for your friends and family. And I have this with a lot of my, I say crew, that when we have my dinners at my house or parties or at theirs, and we have our close friends around, we always make little speeches, and we always just think about the kind of moments going, actually, we're all very, very busy, and to get us all together in a room just to sit down and break bread, which is what the Italians and Spanish people are very, very good at, and food and wine and that sort of thing brings people together.
Mm.
We're actually quite a very open and forward-thinking group of people that we actually realise that what you're saying is that your diamonds are your actual success.
Mm.
And it's interesting to think, how do you see the kind of world around you now that now you have your different kind of viewpoint of success, and how do you interpret the world in your work as well as your social life?
I'm very appreciative of everything I have, and that, to be honest, probably came in over the last decade, and the appreciation, the gratefulness, the gratitude that you have for, I have a fucking wonderful life.
Mm.
You know, I travel where I want to go, I do what I want to do, I've got nobody sitting on me really. I mean, every now and again the pressures of work will come in and say, oh, you have to finish this by then, or you have to do that, but normally I have a really good life, and I am extremely grateful for that. So every day I write a diary first thing in the morning. I write of all the things that I'm grateful for.
Mm.
And they haven't really changed.
Mm-hmm.
They're named diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, each day they're the wonderful greetings that I get when I arrive, say, at Soho Farm for my coffee in the morning or whatever it may be. They don't really change on a day-to-day basis because they're kind of solid, and they're what give me contentment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think previously my self-awareness wasn't that good.
Mm-hmm.
And I was chasing happiness. Mm-hmm. And I chased happiness in ways that are quick,
mm-hmm.
through alcohol, through drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I chased happiness in things that were about greed and about one-upmanship, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I've got a better car than you, I've got a better house than you, I must be better than you. No.
Just materialistic things.
It's just wank.
But also, I think what people do underestimate and are confused about is that I think Tony Robbins says this really great quote, and I keep saying it all the time, is that your mind is like your body with exercise, and so you have to exercise your body to keep toned, but you also have to exercise your mind. And being happy and happiness and contentfulness isn't a one-off thing. It's a daily ritual. It's a daily thing that you have to constantly keep exercising.
Yeah. I don't believe happiness is the thing to chase. I think contentment, because contentment's solid, and it's much harder to sway off course.
Mm,
whereas happiness can come and go. I can be happy right now, and then you can say something to me that upsets me, and then I might still be happy, but I'll probably be less happy.
Yeah.
But generally, if I look at the life, I'm very content with my life, and contentment. I don't want, that sounds smug, but it's not meant to be smug. It's meant to be like don't. You know,
count your blessings.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I like the fact that it also makes you a better person, because the way I do this diary is in the mornings. I'm literally seeking for things to write in the evening that are positive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I'm looking for more and more positive experiences each day. But you know, and that positivity normally comes coming back to your meals with your friends and your statements.
Yeah, then, yeah.
Is that we are a tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and so when we were born, when we were little babies and whatever, we came out to be a social group,
mm-hmm.
but we were also loved, right? And somewhere along the line, our love of other human beings as a group gets kind of fractured, or something happens,
mm-hmm.
so you start feeling like, well, that group of people, you know, because I was always related to greed, because I hate the fact that I live in an area where greed is being rewarded all the time. So, you know, the biggest houses in the Cotswolds are owned by the greediest people. You know, the Range Rovers are screaming up and down the crunchy roads. And none of these people seem very happy to me.
How do you know they're not happy, though? Are they...
Because they look fucking miserable most of the time.
Oh, well, there you go, that's probably why.
And I don't get it. I don't get why we're not... You know, when I was brought up in a small village, so it was a very villagey type vibe, you know, everybody knew everybody. In fact, when I ran away from home, the woman who drove me from the village to the local bus station was a villager. She had no idea what was going on. She was like, "Where are you going, James?" And I was like, "I just want to go to town. I want to go to Northampton, you know." Yeah. That was our nearest big town. And she's like, "Oh, I'm going there." So she drove me in. And then she found out she was an accessory to my breakout.
Oh, wow. Oh, fair enough.
But anyway, I don't know. It feels that
do you feel like these people who are in the Cotswolds who have these big houses and big cars, do you think they ever relook at themselves and reflect and see that they are unhappy and they do something about it, or they just kind of get on with their life and they go, "Oh, this is what I'm feeling, this is what my life is, and that's what it should be"?
You can tell. I mean, I know plenty of people who have successfully, you know, with, you know, and have done awfully well with the cash and stuff. Who are good at what they're, you know, have seen what they're doing, and they understand that it's about family and it's about, you know, you can tell these people who they're generous in everything, in spirit, in everything,
mm-hmm.
Especially family. You can see that within family, but you mm-hmm. can also see the ones that have made it and are turning around and saying, "Well, is that it? You know, what's going on? Mm-hmm. Why aren't I happy?" And they're the ones, like, you open a door for them at the farm or something and they just breeze past you mm-hmm. and they scowl at you
mm-hmm.
and you're like, "What have I done?"
Open
the door for you, man.
It goes back to the whole kind of like, everyone's got their own issues and it's just coming at you, but it's not about you. It's just they've got their own stuff. And this is one of the whole mindfulness we were saying about, like, sometimes we just don't need to react to those sort of situations because they're not even about you. It's something totally different. No. Just coming your way.
And I think that's, I'm just saying before we even start recording, that I used to get angry about things, and I think it's quite, in creativity, it's quite good to get angry from time to time because it, you know,
comes out in your work.
It's an emotional thing. Yeah. But I don't. And what I do is I get frustrated now, and when I'm getting frustrated, I try to deflect the frustration before it becomes anger. So I'm like, okay, so you know, why am I getting pissed off that this happened? Nothing I could do about it. There's nothing I'm going to do about
it's
it
just
now.
A waste of energy.
So I'm just going to deflect that over there. It's fine. Let that go and move on. And,
yeah.
And, you know, maybe, you know, when you're young, you don't think that wisdom is something that is really a thing. You just think old people think it's, just kind of like, oh, yeah, wisdom. Yeah, it's because we're old. We've got nothing left.
Mm-hmm.
No, but I think you do actually get slightly wiser and more sort of reflective as you get older, and you could turn around and go, okay, you know, did I waste that time? Yeah, I might have wasted that time. I don't want to waste time anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, I want
to. Time is so short.
Yeah, I want to. You know, you don't have to be Bill Gates. You don't have to rule the world. You don't have to run Amazon. All you need to do is be on your journey. Is to be the best person that you can for yourself, but also for the people that you care about and the people around you that you love. And you know, what I think about the love thing is that it's that great, you know, it's this is where the tribe really should come together, that we should always be emoting love for other people, because that only ever pays you back. It only ever, you know, I haven't done anything big gesture wise in terms of the charitable acts. I haven't gone and built a school in India. I haven't done any of that yet, but I bet if I did, I'd be really happy while I'm doing it. And that sounds really strange.
No, I'm sure you would be.
I did do a youth theatre for 3 summers. We did a youth theatre project where we did a play in a week for disadvantaged kids, and basically built the sets, did everything, got there at 7 a.m, left at midnight, you know, because it was all up against it and what have you.
Yeah.
And each time that ended, when you're knackered and the show's just gone on and you've got splinters and you've broken all your fingernails,
mm-hmm.
I mean, best week ever, you know. And as soon as the guys would say, "Hey, do you want to come and do this?" "Yep, put me down in August, I'm doing it." And you know, people are like, "You're going to go on holiday?" No, doing the week at the theatre with the kids.
Yeah.
Because it had this payback of actual honest work,
mm-hmm.
but also just seeing the progression of these people who had, you know, inner city issues, you know, weren't having a great start in their lives, having a, you know, just this wonderful introduction to theatre, and then, you know, all, I mean, it's just the payoff of seeing a performance of people that walked in on the Monday scared of what they were about to do and then overcoming it and being like,
yeah, there's something so magical about development and seeing people progress who've never knew that their ability was there, and you've harnessed it and you've developed it, and I find it really, really satisfying when you give someone a new idea to think about, which totally changes the way that they think or think of themselves.
Yeah.
Which I find really, people who are starting out in the world, and I'm just like in their early careers, and they come and they ask for advice, or people who are studying and that sort of thing, and I find it so fascinating to offer them a piece of advice that I've learned from an amazing successful person or a friend of mine who's a mentor or that sort of thing. It totally changes the way that they direct their course of life. And I did that recently for a friend of mine who was at a ballet school, and she was like, I don't want to do dance anymore. And I said, well, what do you want to do? She was like, I think maybe marketing or PR. And I then helped her out in that area. And then she was at a very big PR company. And it was so satisfying to actually go, you know what, I've actually kind of helped you redirect your life to something that you're more successful and also more happy doing. So that's quite a nice kind of feeling to have. And you've obviously had that when you were working on the youth project.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that. I think if you can do something that makes you feel, it wasn't actually the youth project thing that started me thinking this is great. It was being tired,
and oh, really?
About being honestly tired, like working like literally. We were building sets, and I'm not a set builder. I can't even use a screwdriver the right way, you know. And I'm doing this stuff and like hitting my thumbs with hammers and getting in bruised and what have you, and dirty and tired, and getting in the shower, and then someone's, you know, the girlfriend at the time saying, "What time are you going in tomorrow?" I'm like, 6. I want to get there 2 hours before the kids get in. I want to get this done, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah,
And so, but obviously then the payoff is at the end of the week when the kids have done the show, because you see those kids who you saw on Monday. And I mean, you know, I like honesty. So like we're wandering around going, there's no way this show's going to work. This is going to be a complete disaster. Look, these kids can't even talk to each, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then by the end of the week, everything's brilliant. There's an audience and everybody's happy, and the kids have completely grown, and everything. So, you know, I don't want to sound like, oh yeah, I looked for a good call, you know, a dutiful cause to support. No, I firstly paid me back in tiredness and thinking, oh my god, I've just done an honest day's work for free. But then it paid me back. The double bubble was then the play going off well, and the audience liking it, and everybody being really happy.
For sure.
So yeah, I don't know.
Do you think though, in your kind of current role as a screenwriter and in any other kind of every role that people are working, whether it is in advertising or in art and fashion or whatever it is, do you think there's a happy medium balance where you can be as successful and as happy and content at your life with your family and friends? Do you think there's a balance with that?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think you need to drop ego. And it was quite interesting. I said to a woman I'm completely in love with, we dated for a couple of years, and then we went our separate ways, but she's one of my diamonds. And I see her quite often. We pop over, and she lives in Warsaw in Poland, and I pop over and I'm going to have dinner with her. And I was saying one night, you know, this next project's going to win me definitely a BAFTA, probably an Oscar. And she's like, really? Okay, I'm glad that you're believing that. I'm like, no, this is brilliant. This
is an absolute brilliant thing, right? Manifest that.
And she went, why do you want that? I said, so when I walk into Soho House, people fucking know who I am for a change. Right? And she went, well, that's completely the wrong reason. She goes, you're just doing that for ego, right? It's not going to bring you any happiness. And then I was like, you are completely 100% right. That's why I love you, that you can see into that and then realise it's no good.
Yeah.
And reality is what the only thing you can do is stuff that makes you happy and proud of yourself, right? And just in those the way that people, I was going to have a tattoo last time I was there. It was going to say the French for you are missing. I miss you, but tu me manques. You are missing from me. And again, I never miss appointments. I'm one of those people that was brought up to like always be there, but for some reason my computer kept telling me that I had this tattoo appointment, and I was like, no, it's tomorrow. So I was in a script meeting with a writer I'm working on a film in Poland with, And it kept going, ding, appointment, appointment. I'm like, no, that's wrong. It's tomorrow. It's tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It was then. So I went to the tattoo parlor and they were closed. And I'm like, but I've got an appointment. And I looked at it and it was the day before. Right? And I was like, this has never happened to me in my life, honestly. I don't miss trains. I don't miss planes. I don't miss anything. So I get to lunch with Lara and I tell her this. And she went, that's because you shouldn't have that written on you. Right? You shouldn't have had, you were missing from me. Nothing's missing from you. The whole of you.
Is you.
Is you.
Yeah, yeah. There's no one greater than yourself.
Yeah, another person isn't going to complete you. Right? And as soon as you understand that, you will be complete.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I'm 54, right? I shouldn't be learning shit like this from other people.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're right. And I was going to walk around with that written on my body. Yeah, okay, fair enough. And it's that, it's stuff like that when you're almost educated in one way about this is success is going to be here, this is going to be that, everything's going to be that, and you follow these things. And society, because of the, and I'm going to blame writers here, you know, because of the way people write films and people write, this is, you know, this is what happens in romance, this is what happens in things, right?
Warped reality, isn't it?
We see this warped reality all the time, and then we believe it because we go, and then you do see that a lot in people who go, you know, I know so many kids who are trying their best to be Kim Kardashian, or, you know, have that look in girls of about 17 to 19 year old now, you know, they've got this, like, their makeup is the same, etc. It's complete role model based on, actually, is that a role model? I don't know.
You know,
but
sure.
but it's twisted in many respects. Social media has done that. It's also, social media, I think, doesn't promote love. It promotes, when I'm away, I do a lot of Instagramming. I take lots of pictures. So when I'm 90, I can look at all the food I've ever eaten.
Yeah, for sure, in the last 30 years. For sure.
But also, I was standing on the beach one day and I was going, ching, like that. And, and the girl I was with, she went, what are you doing? I said, I'm just making sure everybody's jealous of where I am. And then I went, that's not a positive thing to do, is it?
No, you just want to, yeah.
Right? So then I was like, no, I've got to stop doing this now. Because basically, I'm just, why?
You know, what are you validating?
Why?
Yeah.
And I'm like,
But do you think even before social media, this is like a theory, do you even think before social media, when even Marilyn Monroe was around, there was still people wanting to idolise and be like her, even Kim Kardashian? So it hasn't changed because we have social media and people's perception of wanting to be something else like these idols. Because maybe I'm wrong in this sort of sense, but maybe when Audrey Hepburn was around and Marilyn Monroe, they were like goddesses.
Oh my, I wanted to be James Dean so bad.
They were like goddesses. MJ back in the day, Prince back in the day. And so now they're kind of normalised now. They're not as not as high up on a pedestal. So do you still feel like they're, even back when social media wasn't around, that was still a thing that you wanted to aspire to be?
I got a series idea which I put to ITV a while ago, and I should actually take it back. If anybody wants to steal it, feel free. I haven't got the time to do it. And it was called Famous. And it was about a celebrity agent whose father used to represent proper talented people, like actors. So people like, you know, that we've just been talking about, like Marilyn Monroe or Marlon Brando or James Dean, represented proper talent. And he runs a talent agency, or an agency in the States. And now all he's representing is reality stars. And he can't deal with it because he's basically saying that these people are famous because they've slept with footballers, or or they've done this thing on, you know, on an island somewhere, and they've done. And he's like, you know, where's the
craftsmanship?
And what's the point of representing these people?
Yeah, sure.
I don't like them anymore. Anyway, so he's in episode one. I remember pitching it. It was actually like a story of a record company having this artist who's massively into drugs, and he's representing the artist, and he sees the record company actually feeding this person the drugs because they want that person to die.
Once
they die, their record sales go through the roof.
Right.
So there's the episode one was this dark, very dark thing of him actually, you know, recognizing that basically he needs to save this person. I thought it was quite good. Anyway, they didn't pick up on it, but I do think that the only slight difference is that when people were famous 20, 30, 40 years ago, they were famous for a reason, and now there's fame for not necessarily great reasons.
Well, I do hope that people come away from this podcast listening, going, "What, like,
what the hell happened there?"
Well, yeah, well, no, but more to the point of the success element of like you can be happy and also be very successful, like I don't know, Bill Gates or whoever it is, or these people, but you just have to monetize it and just know and reflect quite a lot, because it's not saying that the success in terms of how we deem, or some most people deem success in their career and being famous, and because fame is not going to give you happiness. And
as we've seen many a time.
Yeah, but in terms of like success and be happy within what you're creating within your work, and if that leads to awards and that sort of thing, then that's great. But also knowing that family and friends are also the main cause of your success and contentfulness.
No, I think definitely the core thing is find the thing you love, right? Because when you're doing the thing you love, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It really doesn't matter, because it's paying you back immediately all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Find the people you love, because essentially that they will be the gold and the diamonds, and that's your true wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Those people.
Amen to that.
You know, smile when you're doing it.
This is true.
Don't be angry about it.
Yeah.
There's no point.
Because we're very, I mean, within the creative industry at the moment, who's in the creative industry, we're very blessed and blessed to be doing what we're doing, and we get to sit at Soho Farmhouse having coffee and that sort of thing, and it's an amazing,
the creative industry, and it was true of similar times in the past, but more so now is more vital than anything else, because it essentially, you know, there's going to be more and more areas where creativity is going to be released. I mean, Apple have just put $1 billion budget, or more than $1 billion, into
film and
production.
Yeah.
You know, Netflix and Amazon, great. But also, we're going to have more time, because you know, basically, there is a realism that 4-day weeks are going to happen.
Mm.
You know, that people are going to be pushing for more leisure time, and that leisure time, that's what creativity can fill really well, can't it? You know.
Yeah.
Creating good content, and content that you know, takes people to different places.
Yeah, and we always forget that actually your own personal time and your own personal relationships actually are the basis into actually your work, and will springboard your feelings and emotions from your personal life into your work, rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
So if you're happy and you'll have leisure doing your seeing the world around you, inspired by grass and nature, and also seeing friends and family and food, that is ultimately going to affect and be a positive aspect into your work life.
Mm.
So having those kind of more time to do these things and be influenced by culture and people, and that is going to obviously have a good effect on your work. If work is your, I don't know, your main focus in terms of where you see fit.
Mm, I think everybody, when they find the thing they love doing, will never stop working anyway, because I think it's whatever that might be. I mean, I was just telling you about the guy that gilds the mirrors and things, you know, he loves doing that, so he does it really well, and everything, you know, everything around him, you know, he takes such pride in his work.
Mm.
Is that, you know, you never really stop working if you enjoy what you're doing. If you don't enjoy what you're doing, the first thing you want to do is retire.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
And you're like, right, 65, I'm stopped now.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Right? Well, no, I don't want to be that person. I want to work until the last breath.
Exactly. It's like Gillian Lynn and Antti Van Asta, who are famous choreographers. I mean,
right.
They're like, I don't know, Gillian Lynn, 89 or something like that. Who's it? Antti Van Asta, got to be in his 80s as well. I mean, I think Gillian Lynn, obviously, I think she passed last year, unfortunately.
Right.
But Antti Van Asta is still going. I mean, he did like Mamma Mia, and he's done like Sister Act and stuff, and he's still going now. He's still going now, only because every time you see him, he's like a light. He's just loving his life. He's like, I can't believe I've been fortunate enough to do what I do. And we are very fortunate if you're on the creative arts and
definitely,
and
definitely.
Stuff. It's important though, because I know a lot of people who are in banking and accountancy and all that sort of thing, and corporate law, who are just doing it for the money. And then do it for the bonuses, and then they're like, oh yeah, I'll do it for 8 years and I'll retire. And I'm like, well, why would you want to do that? Why don't you just find something you really like?
I don't know. I've been down that road, as I said, in my early 30s, and all it did was make me a poisoned, sick person, and my, you know, escaping that need to suckle on the on that success is related to the size of my car or the size of my paycheck. Once I broke out of that and realized it was killing me, that, you know, it's kind of like being freed.
You do feel like, for sure.
Like bang, you know. And guess what? No one dies. It really, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had to find money because I had to survive, and I had to do it. So what do I do? You on what I can do well, I do better, and I get, you know, I get through the doors, and I get work in this business, you know. But it's only hard if you tell yourself it is, and that I think was that beauty of other writers saying to me, "What, you got nominated on your first thing? You got an agent on your first, you know?" I'm like, yeah, but no one told me I was meant to work for 10 years in the desert before this happened. It was like, you need cash, you need to write, you need to, you know, do it. So I did it, you know? So
it's just saying about the whole Nike thing, just do it, isn't it? Just get on and do it.
But also, because going back, just if your mindset is, this is hard, I can't do this because I've been told I can't do this. If your mindset is that, you're never going to do it.
It's true.
Right?
It's true.
You've got to turn your mindset around to be like, no, I can do this.
Yeah, there's a really lovely quote by Will Smith, and he's such an amazing, for me, he's such an amazing motivator.
Right.
And he says the quote, "He who says he can and he who says he cannot are both usually right." And it's true.
It's true,
If you say you can do it, you can do it. If you say you can't do it, you can't do it.
Yeah.
So it's that simple.
Yeah.
And I think more people need to just actually go, you know what, I can do it. And that's it. And just trust. And a lot of it is faith and belief. I mean, not faith in terms of religious, if you are religious, but in terms of faith of your own ability and believe that it's just going to happen.
Yeah. We're good. I mean, humans are very good at achieving things.
Yeah.
We're, you know, by far the best animal on the planet for being able to achieve stuff that we didn't think we could dream of. I mean, who'd have thought, right? My granny, who's dead now, but when she was born in 1900, no one had ever flown, right? Properly, like, and then by the time she was in her 60s, she's flying to New York in an aluminium tube with jet engines on it. In her lifetime, that happened. And we're sitting here and like, who'd have thought that you could take your phone everywhere?
Could you imagine? And record a podcast. Isn't that crazy?
I know. I love that one. That joke about the class, the teacher going, "No, well, you can't use your calculators because you won't have a calculator in the exam." And everybody's just holding the phones up
nowadays.
Going, what?
But it's like saying that the phones nowadays. I think we're digressing now. But
yeah, sorry.
I'm going to leave one thing. But the iPhones now are apparently more powerful than the first Pixar cartoon thing that ever happened, because they had like thousands of computers. And apparently, the phone is more powerful than that. Those thousand computers.
Well, certainly, they landed on the moon. I believe they did.
Cause I did as well.
If they didn't, it really crushes my childhood.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I had the spacesuit and everything, but certainly they had like a 32 megabyte computer that landed. It was such a small computer.
I know, and you can do it on your phone nowadays. And it has more technology in your phone than actually did all those computers all these many years ago. Isn't that very scary?
It's very.
So it thinks about what's going to be in the future in 20.
Actually, that's the wrong word. It's not very scary. It's very exciting.
Oh, I don't know. I'm a bit scared slightly about how human beings and the technology world and how we're going to be disconnected. I think it's going to implode on us at some point, and we're going to try and find more kind of human connections in life
for sure.
The thing I'm kind of very scared of, because I'm not tech savvy at all, and I'd much rather have a phone conversation or meet someone in person. And the amount of people who hate phone conversations and hate voice notes and much to do it over the phone, I'm like, oh man, please, I don't want to, don't send me a text. Just come and meet me for coffee, or just call me. I'd much rather have that.
And it's so much quicker as well.
Isn't it?
You don't have a 32 email chain thing just to arrange a meeting at a house.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You could just go, all right, I'm going to be there in 15. Bye. Ciao.
Exactly. And it's so crazy that people get in.
And there's people making a fortune out of digital detox weekends and getting people away from their phones.
Yeah.
Which, you know, completely. I don't do anything. I only do Insta now, but I used to do Twitter. I had like 22,000 Twitter followers, right?
Uh-huh.
All actors who wanted work, right? But because I had them, I felt I had to feed them.
That's what happened.
And
yeah.
it took over my life. Mm-hmm. And then I realised I wasn't doing any writing other than in 100 and whatever characters each day. I was just writing tweets for these people,
mm-hmm.
trying to be as funny as possible, and then realised that actually they wasn't paying me any money, and why was I doing it?
Exactly.
So I got rid of that and Facebook, because I was sick of Facebook being the ability for my mother to attack me. But that's a completely different story.
No, I've got my mother on the other side going, Jamie, that's wonderful, great, lovely, you're so beautiful.
Oh, we see, I travel a lot. And, yeah. I, if I don't have 2 airline tickets on my phone at any one point, I'm really upset. I need to have my next trip planned and the one after planned.
Oh, right, okay.
And as a result of... I mean, I'm sorry about that for anybody who is worried about the environment. Yeah, sorry, I'll be dead.
that's not great.
No, sorry, it isn't good. They are going to make electric planes soon.
They are.
I heard about that.
Yeah, I did hear about this as well.
So on that side, I'm sorry about that, but... because I travel so much, when the Brexit thing happened, I was actually in Poland in bed with my girlfriend, mm-hmm. when it happened, when the vote came through in the morning that we'd lost and that yeah. we were leaving Europe. Uh-huh. And my mum had voted to leave Europe and I hadn't. So this actually did...
No, my parents as well also voted to leave as well, because they're different era and they're very yeah. different generation.
So big
but also
split.
They're from a village town.
Right.
So, they have a totally different... mindset about how Brexit should be and all that sort of thing.
Well, we can't talk about it, because if we do, we argue too much. So
yeah.
it's completely off the
table.
Same
thing for
now.
Me as well. Same thing for me and my dad. Because I wanted to stay, because it's much, much much more forward to stay. And there's much
I don't believe things. In borders. I don't believe in putting walls up under.
Yeah, me too. I think everyone should just be as they be.
So as a result, I had to take Facebook down, because every time I put up a positive thing about staying in Europe,
yeah.
she would reply with something negative.
No.
And I was like, this is going to end in tears, and I don't want to fall out with my mum properly.
For sure, for sure.
I just, you know, because at the end of the day, you know, she did give birth to me, and she's, you know, I love her.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can't be in a situation where I'm being called out by my mum.
For sure,
all
on
the
Facebook.
Time.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So I called it.
Anyway, we should wrap this up, but I want to say thank you so much for giving me your time.
Yeah, thank you.
I hope we've waffled on a lot of different things, but
we
I
have.
Hope kind of...
It's going to be a hard edit for you.
Yeah, well, yeah, I hope... what we've discussed is kind of going to help people deciding kind of where their career path is going to be and whether something is worth doing if you're not really happy about it in terms of your career or your life and what success means for you. Because I think that question always is pondering around my friends and myself is going, what is success? And am I success now, or do I think I'm going to be successful soon? And
yeah.
what sort of thing?
Thing is, when going back to, because just one little... thing, because I didn't know, right? And I, that's the other aspect of that.
Mm-hmm.
I knew, I'd been told that success was based upon money and
materialistic things,
and so I went along with that. Mm-hmm. And it's no failure for you not to find what you're in love with straight off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people mm-hmm. just keep trying and keep looking and keep and it's when you learn about yourself and
mm-hmm.
learn what makes you tick. Because you do, you start looking inwardly more and more, and maybe when you start thinking what you're actually grateful for in
mm-hmm.
life, when you learn those things, then you'll find that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not something that anybody, if you ever do walk out into your first job or you know in your early 20s, and you go, this is, you know, you're very lucky.
Yeah.
Because most people have to have to search out. You know, they
yeah.
have to find it.
I was actually speaking to someone this morning at a company that was just that, and she was just got her first job in this company, and she was like, I like the job, but it's not what I want to do, because I'm more hands-on. And I was like, oh well, maybe you should go and intern somewhere, or go and like reach out to someone that you think that you'd like to do, like if it's production design or
yeah.
styling, whatever. But you're very lucky if you do
fall into that straight away.
I mean, I fell into my job really. I mean, if I think about 6 years ago, if I go, what am I doing now? Like, I'd be like, oh my god, I mean, that's crazy. How'd you get to that? And then always. There's a question going, how'd you get into what you're doing? I'm like, oh, I just fell into it.
Unless you're like studying medicine or veterinary or whatever, I don't think that many people have any idea.
Yeah.
And they,
you let the universe do its thing and then you just kind of go along with it. Yeah. Right, well, anyway, so thank you so much, Jim, for
Pleasure.
Coming along and giving me your time. I think it's been a wonderful, wonderful chat, and we've got on some amazing topics and subjects. So please do check out this episode. It's Jim Davies, And I think it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful listen for everyone there.
Thank you.
This is 360 Yourself, and I'm Jamie Neal. Please subscribe to our listings every 2 weeks on a Sunday. We are on all social media platforms. Please, please subscribe if you really enjoy our 360 chats. You can also find us on Instagram at 360-yourself, and also for our host, that's me, Jamie Neal JN. Thank you so much for listening.